Finance Manager Leadership for Nashville.
Thank you, sir.
First of all, I'd like to begin by apologizing to this poor devotee. He had this camera yesterday, and I went over to him to use that camera as an example, and I think I somehow or other implied that he was stolen it or something. I was just trying to collect my thoughts about, you know, I had a camera once and it was stolen here in Mayapur. And then I think I might have embarrassed him. I want to apologize. That was not at all my intention. Okay. What do we need as human beings? This is a question that we want to answer for creating a proper culture. We need to care for the body, food, clothing, shelter. We also need to care for the soul, as in spiritual development. What else do we need? We need community. We need society. In other words, as an individual, somebody might live in a cave, all by themselves, caring for the body, caring for the soul. But most people can't do that. Most of us, we are live in society. We live together with others. Problem is, in modern society, this social arrangement is broken down. And the result is, there is one French philosopher, Emile Durkheim, I think it was.
Yeah.
He had this concept called anomie. Anomie means that when a person's needs are not met, they basically go crazy. They can't deal with things in a stable way. This is, of course, increasing in modern society. We have more and more people taking psychotropic drugs in order to be able to deal with modern life. And of course, even that is not sufficient. Many people commit suicide, and I think among teenagers now, suicide is the third leading cause of death, something like that. It's very, very high. So, first thing I want to talk about before I get into the economics part, I want to talk about society in general. Let's see. I asked yesterday who has a job. So, we have a bit of a different audience today. How many have a job? Now, I wonder for those who don't have a job, what's your place in society? Generally, women, their place in society is defined by the family. Their mother or wife, they take care of their families. A man's place in society is defined by his, generally by his occupation, or his job. But this is not now an easy thing for a man to achieve. Consequently, we see many young men, I don't know about here in India, but in other parts of the world, in America, for example, we have not so young men, even up into their 30s, who are still lost. They don't know where to fit in. Maharaj was saying to you the other day, was saying about this young man after the graduation ceremony. He was saying, where's my place? Where do I fit into this? This is a problem. So these young men, we see they're 30 years old, they're still running around on their skateboards, right, with baggy pants, and because they don't know where to fit in modern society. So this is a problem that the Krishna culture, the Vanashram culture, solves very easily. I guess we could use that word easily. Why do we have such a fractured society? Anybody want to guess? I've got a reason, but maybe you want to suggest.
Families don't support each other, a lot of broken families.
We can consider that an effect, not a cause.
objection for the point that I'm going to make. Anybody else?
Chaos.
And chaos is also an effect. Anyway, I'll stop with that.
Spiritual education.
That's good. But it's something more fundamental than that, actually. And yesterday I was speaking about the subtlety of culture and how we don't even see or notice the effects of culture. But I want to suggest to you that the reason that we have such a fractured society is this. Money. What does money do that creates this effect? Money destroys relationships. Because if I have money, I can be independent. Right? I don't need you. I've got enough money, I can take care of myself. And it doesn't matter whether I'm a woman or a man. A woman, if she has money, she doesn't need a man. So, get rid of that guy. He's so much trouble anyway. Just divorce him. But I want to point out that this so-called independence is actually an illusion. We may think that we're independent, but not at all. Because if I have money, I can go get the things that I want, right? If there's a person in the store to sell me those things that I want. If there's a person who drove the things to the store. If there's a person who works in the electric power plant to put the lights on so that there's light and electricity in the store. If there's a person who manufactured those goods somewhere very far away, maybe in China or somewhere around the world, that were sent to the store. If. We're actually dependent on many, many, many people. Even if you take another example, just the act of eating. Now, here in this area of the world, the economy is very local, I understand that. But anybody who's from a city, a large metropolitan area, outside of India, you can't even eat without the help of several thousand people. Again, all those people to make the cars, make the oil, make the gasoline, make the roads, make the stores, make the electricity, make all these things, so that we have the convenience of going down there, putting our money on the counter, and taking home the things that we want. This is not independence. This is a great dependence. And where it's actually Shalabra Prabhu was saying this morning, a very, very fragile system. Now, money, it destroys relationships because it gives us freedom. I've got freedom, but I can be independent. There's a corollary, another part to that, is that the more freedom I have, the more shallow my relationships must be. Okay. I want to have close, meaningful, deep relationships. But in order to have those kind of relationships, I have to give up my freedom. Let's take husband and wife, for example. A man and woman, they commit themselves to each other. They don't act in practically any stage of life without the agreement of their spouse. If they do, of course, it creates a lot of problems in the marriage. So their freedom is restricted immediately by becoming married. They restrict their freedom of not doing anything that the other person is not agreeable to do. Let's take the Pandavas, another very good example. Yudhisthira in the gambling match, he was gambling away the whole kingdom, everything that they had. He gambled away their wife. And what did the brothers do?
Nothing.
Why? Because Yudhisthira was the eldest, and whatever he said, they were committed to. They had very, very tight, deep relationship. But because of that also, their freedom was restricted. So there's a trade-off. We don't get one without the other.
We can't have the idea of freedom without having the idea of loneliness or being by ourselves. If we want to have deep, meaningful relationships where we feel secure, we have to be willing to give up freedom.
This is a very significant part in developing a Vanashram culture. Because Vanashram culture means all for one and one for all. It's not a place for independence. It's a place where all the members of the culture are committed to helping maintain the other members. It's their commitment, their duty. Vanashram culture has mutual dependence. Not independence, mutual dependence. And this is something that we actually, this is sometimes, like I said, although the idea of freedom is often given a lot of emphasis, a lot of play, and so it's a very significant thing. I don't know about the rest of the world, but in America, we have this idea, oh yes, we're all free. Actually, we're not so free in America at all, but they have this idea, yes, I want to be free, I want to be free. But the result is, of course, again, that we don't have the meaningful, the deep relationships that we want. So in Vanashram culture, in the Krishna culture, we have to understand that we're in this together. That we work together, we support each other, and we follow the authority, whatever that may be, whether it's the Brahmana, or the Kshatriya, or the Guru. These three authorities mainly, or the parents. By doing that, we can actually achieve real happiness. Because one of the things that makes people everywhere happy is when they feel secure, cared for, and loved. There was some British researchers, probably 6 or 7 years ago now, they did a study to find out who the happiest people in the world are. So, anybody want to guess? According to country, who's the happiest people in the world?
Bangladesh.
You heard me say that last year?
Yeah,
Bangladesh.
When I tell that in the Western countries, they also, Bangladesh? Because they have this preconceived idea of Bangladesh being nothing but a dirt, poor, poverty-stricken country. But yes, Bangladesh, because they have those committed relationships. Bhakti Vikas Maharaj, he wrote a very wonderful book. You know the name? Simple Village Life?
Glimpses
of Traditional Indian Village Life. It's a wonderful book, and if you want to get a glimpse of what traditional village life or our future Vanashram life should be, read that book. It's very, very good.
Okay, let's get into today's topic. What time do I have to stop? Can I go till 4:30?
Yeah.
Okay.
What is it?
Paper money.
Okay. What else is it?
Credit card.
Huh?
Credit card.
Credit card?
Credit note.
Credit note. If it was American one, I would say. I don't know about India, but how they. Somehow I was discussing that point with some devotees here. They say India is a little different. Maybe not. It's money?
Kali is in it.
Kali is in it, yeah. It sure is. It's money, and it's also paper. Okay?
What's the difference between this paper and this paper?
Power. Okay, that's one way of saying it. If I go down to the bazaar, and I want to buy some japa mala and a nice new japa bag, and I give them this paper, what will they say?
No, they can't do that.
You have to give them this paper, not that paper. So what makes this paper special?
Promises.
Who said it?
They
have some promise.
Promise? Oh, what's the promise?
Governor promises, I give this value of rupees 100.
That's close, but no cigar. Sorry.
That's not the reason. What makes this one special? What makes this one worth?
It has value.
It has value.
But
why?
It's issued by the...
It's issued by the central bank?
Okay, let's try this another way.
Let's see, let me try to make another little experiment again without embarrassing anybody. who's this is a nice reporter? Who's this?
It's Maharaj.
I'll be very careful. Maharaj, can I buy that from you?
I can steal it. Not to sell.
Just cooperate with me. What could I give you for that?
Okay, here. This fellow might be more cooperative. He's got a nice whatever it is. Personal information management trick, we call these. Can I buy that from you? Say yes. And I'll pay you $500 for it. Okay? Is that fair? Say yes. Okay. What did we just do?
We agreed.
We had an agreement. What makes this work?
Agreement.
We have an agreement. Huh? It works because everybody agrees that it works. Huh? Now, what did we agree to that?
When we were 12 years old or something, we go and have a national assembly and we all put our hand on our heart and say, yes, I agree to accept paper money for value.
When did we agree?
We didn't.
It's called an implicit agreement. Huh? Implicit because the whole society accepts it. But by itself, does it have any value, this piece of paper?
No.
It's not even as good as this paper because this paper we can write on, right? There's not even any room to write on this. It's just a piece of paper. But what gives it value is our agreement that you have to say, yes, this is 100, right? And
here we got another one. This one says 10.
So this one is worth 10 times more than this one. Because there's 10 times more paper?
No.
Why? Because we agree. We agree that this one is 10, and we agree that this one is 100. That's what makes it work. The whole Western culture is based on this implicit agreement. The problem with this is it's an illusion. Because it's just paper. It doesn't have any value. What it does, who said sense gratification? Yeah. It's a promise for future sense gratification. We work hard to get money. We work hard to get money because it's a promise to us that in the future I'll get something for that. I'll get sense gratification that I want. So, because it's based on illusion, and because the motivating factor for working for this is sense gratification, it doesn't really reflect the values that we espouse as devotees of Krishna.
sense gratification is supposed to not be so significant for us, the Krishna Prema being much more valuable, and the two being mutually exclusive. What we'd like to do is to see, yesterday I spoke about Krishna's instructions in the Bhagavad Gita for an economic system. And what we want to do is try to establish that economic system in such a way so that it reflects our values, it reflects what we believe to be the truth. This stuff doesn't do it. Just doesn't do it. Now, in our Varnashram culture, the economy functions in quite a different way. How's the economy going to function there? If sense gratification is the driving force for the modern materialistic economy, what's the driving force for the Krishna economy? Or the Dayavivanashram economy? Any suggestion?
Self-realization.
Okay. That's a big step. How about, is there a smaller step?
Big things. Selling big things.
Okay. We want to act.
Exchange.
We want, our purpose in devotional service is to please Krishna. And we do that in what's called devotional service. If our goal is to please Krishna by engaging in his service, then devotional service becomes our motivation for what we do. I gave the example yesterday of Prabhupada's temples. We have so many devotees all over the world performing devotional service there. Does anybody get a paycheck from that? Not usually, although that's starting to happen, much to my disagreement. No, the devotees, they come to the temple to render devotional service to Krishna without desiring anything in exchange, only for the pleasure of the Lord. This is what goes on in Vaikuntha. The gopis, there in Vaikuntha, they're engaged in cleaning the walls. Even though the walls are made out of chintamani, they don't even get dirty. But why do they do that? Because they want to please Krishna by their devotional attitude. So this is the position that we aspire to come to. We want to come to that level of devotional service where we want to please only Krishna. And that in itself is our own reward. So, in the beginning, we're not quite motivated like that. In the beginning of coming to Krishna consciousness, we're not really motivated by pure devotional service. Our motivation instead is based on duty, right? We follow the instructions of the spiritual master so that we can come to that platform of pure devotional service. And in that process, we do our duty. We do it because it should be done. Duty is another one of those concepts that's almost entirely lost in the dominant atheistic culture. There's still some semblance of duty to family members. Perhaps some civic duty for some people. But by and large, the sense of duty is going by the wayside. This also needs to be reestablished because the whole Varnashram culture is actually based on duty. Everywhere in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna speaks about the mode of goodness, he mentions duty. And Maharaj was making the point also the other day that we have to come, he's quoting from Prabhupada, that we have to come to the standard of Sattva-guna. If we're engaged in fruitive activity, this is Rajaguna.
And because fruitive activity takes up such a major part of the day, it's very difficult for one engaged in rajagun to come to the standard of sattvagun. I'll give you a little personal testimony here. I gave up my, I took up the preaching mission again about 5 years ago. And I've been traveling and preaching in that time. And since that time, living in Prabhupada's temples and by the grace of the other devotees, again, I feel my devotional mood has increased a lot because I'm engaged full time in preaching activity. Before it was not the case. When I had a job before, it was very difficult for me to be able to maintain Krishna consciousness and at the same time go to work and associate with non-devotees and just even to be around them, what to speak of picking up their values. So, our Varnashram economy is based on duty. This is a driving force. Duty, and then at the more advanced stage, to pure devotional service. Did you print out that enough? Can I see one please? Okay. So let's talk about the economics of Vanashandra. In the present society, economics is based on the concept of buying, personal ownership, unlimited personal private property, and with this medium of exchange called money. These things should be absent in the Daivi Vanashram culture. Instead, we have the concept that Krishna is the owner of everything. Now, if Krishna, that's a nice idea, but in a practical sense, how do we deal with that? We deal with that in a way that Krishna has representatives in this world who act on his behalf. So one of those personalities is called the Kshatriya, or the king. The Kshatriya, he is representative of the Lord, and he takes care of the Lord's property. So if he has a kingdom, that land, everything in that kingdom, technically, he controls on behalf of the Lord. What I'm going to present to you is one of my ideas of Vanashram economics. I'm not saying that this is the absolute truth, this is the way it has to be. In fact, there may be many, many variations. But I'm going to present the idea that I've developed in my years of study on this topic. The Kshatriya, he's the owner of everything. He builds the houses in the community. He owns the houses. Everybody who's in that community lives there at his grace. He's like what we might call the temple president in our ISKCON model. His job is to see that everybody is properly engaged. And if they're not, he can chastise them or kick them out of the kingdom. That's his job, his duty as a Kshatriya. What he does, let's say he's the king of all this land here, and there's people in his kingdom, and he says, okay, you're a Vaishya, and here I'm going to give you 2 hectares of land. You can work that. And you, you can take 3. Okay. This fellow here, he's very intelligent. He knows how to work with people. He can actually handle the money. According to the ability of the individuals,
the Chatriya gives them resources to use according to their ability and according to their interests. So if somebody likes to work with wood, he may give them a forest, or if they're not quite capable of handling a forest, he'll give them wood in a wood shop, and then they make wood. If he gives a man more than what he can use, he observes that, and then he sees, okay, this man's ability is not up to that level. And he'll adjust it accordingly, giving more resources to somebody else who has ability. The idea is that every person should have facility commensurate with his ability, so that he feels challenged, so that he feels he can use his productive energy. Right? People want to do that. People want to be able to give their energy. They want to be able to contribute. And one of the problems in modern society is that they don't have the means or the ability to do that. So the Chakya, then he gives that stuff away. The Vaishya, he is a person who can deal with, he knows how to take raw materials. If you give him land, he can produce food. If you give him cows, he can produce milk. If you give him a forest, he can produce houses like this. By his nature, this is what Vaishyas do. Other men, they don't have the ability like that. They become the helpers. They assist others in accomplishing their work. Let's use an example of somebody who goes to apply for a job for a builder. Somebody's building a house. He comes, he doesn't have any experience. What's he going to do? What's the foreman says, okay, well, I need to hire somebody, I need some help. But you don't have any experience, so you can use a shovel, right? Okay, so he can dig a hole over here. And then he can have him clean up this place or that, something like that. As that person stays there, he gains some more and more experience, then he can become perhaps a carpenter's helper. Then he can become a carpenter himself. Then, after he gains even more experience, if he has the ability, he understands. This is what you do first, second, third, fourth. He can become the foreman, the guy who directs several carpenters. If he's got even more ability, then maybe he'll start building houses by himself. This would be called the Vaishya. If he's got even more ability, then he starts whole developments of houses. This is what we might call a Chakya. So, the different varnas, in terms of economics, it depends on what a man can contribute. If a man has ability to control the resources, I would say according to a man's ability to control resources and use them properly, he moves higher and higher up the list of varnas. That's not the only criteria. The other criteria for determining a person's varna is their ability to give service to others. Not only must you have technical knowledge and know how to work with the material energy, but you must also be able to care for people. In the Varnashram system, the Shudra is in the safest and most easy position in the whole society. All that's required of them is to do their duty to the best of their ability. They work for one of the other varnas. And in exchange for that, they're cared for like children. They're given house, they're given food, they're given clothing, they're given medical assistance and whatever other things that they need. But they're not given money and they're not given independence because generally they'll misuse those things. Vaishyas, on the other hand, they must be able to care for those shudras that are working for them. So you're a vaishya that has 3 hectares, and you've got 2 people working for him. Okay, he can do 20, but maybe he's got 10 men working for him. He's got to take care of all 10. If he can't, then his allotment is adjusted accordingly. So the Chakya then, he not only cares, his job is to care for the entire community materially. He has to see that everybody has what they need.
And for that purpose, he's allowed to collect taxes so that in times of distress or some problem or other, he's got resources in order to be able to give out to deal with the situations that might arise. The brahmana, the topmost position in the society, his responsibility is to care for both the material and spiritual welfare of all the people in the community. Material and spiritual. Now, material doesn't mean directly, but he's got to see that somebody has a need, they've got to be taken care of. And he also looks after their spiritual life. So, in the situation as I'm explaining, it's a situation of mutual dependence. The Vaishyas, they can't do what they're capable of doing without the help of the Sudras, neither can the Chakri, neither can the Brahmins. There's a mutual dependence and mutual support that goes on in the society that makes the economy work. And it's all based on duty. Everybody does their duty. Why?
The same reason
we accept this for value. We voluntarily agree to follow these principles of Vedic culture. That's the basis of the society. That's what makes the society much stronger than the current culture, which only is interested in this paper. They could care less about duty or anything else. So, the economy in Dadivan Ashram can function like this. It's a gifting economy. Everybody giving, contributing according to their ability. Practicing Krishna consciousness, the result of which is detachment from interest in material life. So that, due to that, everyone is capable of living very simply without being interested in unnecessarily increasing sense gratification. One last point that I want to make. What's the difference between Vanashram Dharma and Daivi Vanashram? Maharaj, Bhaktiraghava Maharaj, he actually defined this the other day when he was speaking, and I was very happy to see that his explanation of it agreed with mine. I've had not everybody agrees on the same definitions, but in the handout that I prepared for today, there's some quotes by Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was talking, this is a famous room conversation here at Mayapur, February 14th, 1977. Prabhupada was talking with the devotees about Vanashram Dharma, and he said, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, para upakara, why should just a certain section of men be picked up? Previously he had said that, how many people in the world we are controlling, meaning ISKCON. He said, very insignificant. But he said, we are collecting the best of them. But why should just a certain section of men be picked up? Since Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, para upakara. The whole mass of people should get the benefit of it. This is required. Say, say, karma yivarata samsidim labate nara. Para upakara means mass benefit, not just a certain section. Then we have to introduce this Vanashram Dharma. It must be done perfectly. It is possible and people will be happy. So the point there is that Vanashram Dharma is for the mass of people, those who are not able to immediately come to the standard of devotional service. Now, in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains a process of people coming to devotional service. And I'm going to read these verses backwards. This is Slokas 9 to 12, but I'm going to read them backwards to show progressively better steps.
Krishna says, engage yourself in the cultivation of a knowledge. Better than knowledge, however, is meditation. And better than meditation is renunciation of the fruits of action. For by such renunciation, one can attain peace of mind. So try to act, giving up some or all of the results of your work, and try to be self-situated. Better yet, work for me, because by working for me, you will come to the perfect stage. And even better is to follow the regulative principles of bhakti yoga. In this way, you will attain a develop a desire to attain me. But best of all is to worship me, giving up all your activities unto me, being devoted to me without deviation, engaged in devotional service, always meditating upon me, fixing your mind upon me. For such devotees of mine, I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. This last sloka, which is 12, 6, and 7, defines the standard of Daivi Ganasha. These are the perfected souls, those pure devotees who can actually follow Krishna's instructions in Bhagavad Gita. And the most visible demonstration of their ability to do that is how they handle their economic affairs. If they're able to live simply without the conception of proprietorship, ownership, proprietorship, if they're able to give service without expecting some result in return, if they're able to serve others with humility, this is a very high standard of devotional service. Some, but not everybody can do that. Some people, they want to own something. I want to have my house. I want to have my car. Now, immediately, we can see in the juxtaposition of this where we're at. Let me give you an example. We want to go on a road trip. You're going to travel 1,000 kilometers. You get out your map to figure out where you're going to go. You need to know two things to use your map. What are those two things?
Where you know where you're going.
Where you are and where you're going to go. You have to know where you're starting from, right? If you think you're someplace other than where you are, you're not going to get to where you want to go. How do we know where we're at in devotional service? If we think we're somewhere else other than where we are, it's going to be much more difficult for us to get to the destination. In the context of modern society, I can think that I'm a very highly advanced devotee. I chant my vows, I get up from Mangalarti. Of course, I have my house, I have my car, I have my bank account, because those things are required for living. It's more difficult in that situation for me to see, am I attached to that? Do I require this conception that I am the owner, that I am the proprietor? Or not. If we have the possibility of living in a situation where we can be maintained without having those things, then we can easily see if our desire comes up that I want to have my own. I want to be the owner of my car and my house. The context of the gifting economy in Krishna culture, Daivivanas culture, allows us to very easily see our own position and then work from there. We have to work from where we're at. We cannot artificially think we're advanced in that, you know, we just, you know, going to advance from some platform when we're not properly established. So the whole culture, the whole Krishna culture is situated, established in such a way to help us easily move forward in spiritual life. Prabhupada said, we want to pave the way for people to go back to Godhead. And so easily, just by being born, it's almost guaranteed that they're going to go home back to Godhead. Because they're born into a situation where the whole culture is established that everyone automatically does devotional service. Automatically, everybody is trained to serve others. Automatically, everybody is trained from birth to understand that everything belongs to Krishna. I am Krishna's servant, and my duty in this life is to give service to Krishna and his devotees. Without there being any contrary example to that. So, anyway, so we're getting out of time. This is a brief description of my conception of economics in Varnasham Dharma and Dagi Varnasham. Oh, I'm sorry, one more quick point. For somebody who's not on this high standard of pure devotional service, they're attached to the fruits of life. They need an example to understand what is the goal. Varnasham Dharma is a means to help us achieve that goal of Krishna consciousness. But we have to understand what that goal is. And for that, the best thing is an example of others who are actually living in the ideal manner, that we can see how they're living. And by their good example, learn to follow in their footsteps. So we need both. We need to have the Daivivanashram culture of advanced devotees, pure Krishna bhaktas, who can give the example to others so that they know how to progress, what the goal should be of their activities. So we need both. We need Daivivanashram culture as well as Vanashram culture. Okay, I'm going to stop there. So, comments or questions?
Just thinking, what you're saying is interesting, that if the person who is a sakya, the person who is in control, he has a lot of power. So if he misuses that authority, then many lives can be disrupted. And so it's hard for an individual to give everything to Krishna in that sense. If we can't really have trust in a growing figure, then we can give our lives to that degree. So what we see now, that devotees have gone the other way, where they own different things and they're trying to serve Krishna according to their situation. So it seems that we have to bring about some trust in them, and someone who's capable to actually have our trust in that degree.
Dr. Raghavamara spoke to this the other day also, and said that we require qualified Brahmanas, qualified Kshatriyas, qualified Vaishyas, and qualified Shudras. There is no substitute for qualified people. We cannot begin to establish Varnasham culture without qualified people. So, and who's going to do that? We have to do that. We have to become qualified. That means qualified to the point where others are willing to put their trust in us, and we're not going to betray their trust. That also means that they don't place under a reasonable expectation in us, which sometimes there's a tendency to do. So, I think that there's enough good devotees who, if not already qualified, can quickly become qualified. And if they see that there's a place for them and a need for them, then they have more of a motivation, perhaps, than they might otherwise have.
Comment?
Yeah, just very briefly. If we read the instructions in the seventh canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, or Narada Muni presents a whole, in-depth discussion, he is speaking with Yudhisthira Maharaj in the very beginning, and Bhakti Shukla, but also in purport to one of those instructions given by Narada Muni, where he lists, I'm sure some of you will remember, he lists 30 qualities necessary for individuals who have attained the human form of life. There are 30 qualities that need to be developed, and it is amongst those individuals who have the most developed of these qualities, everyone should introduce Varnasana. So as you rightly point out, we need qualified individuals from the highest level, let's say a Brahmana, to the beginning level of Shudra. But of course in a Krishna conscious or larger Vaishnava context, we don't differentiate externally. Prabhupada gives the example, just like a drama. Externally, people are playing different roles. We need to see Varnasham very much like that. Externally, some devotee will be playing the role of Brahmana, some will be playing the role of Kshatriya Vaishya, and also some devotees will be performing activities as Shudra. But it does not mean that one is connected with the modes of material nature that, of course, depend on each individual. So externally, we will have these different occupations because it is not that the devotees are meant only to be in terms of activity, in terms of occupation. It is not that the devotees are meant to be only Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, or Vaishyas. I mean, who is it? Jayananda Prabhu? He was a carpenter.
Taxi driver also.
And taxi driver. And you know, we have devotees who have similar kinds of skills. So, guna and karma. Karma may be the activity may be of a Shudra nature, but the guna, the quality of consciousness, if one is a devotee, seriously practicing, can be that of a pure devotee, very elevated. So what's important is that every single member within the Varnasrama system, and that is why Sri Prabhupada, expected naturally, that the devotees of this Krishna consciousness movement, they are actually the only ones really qualified to take up these roles, to live them out, and to serve as examples for others. It's not that we just do it we do it artificially in the sense that we don't take up these different occupations. I mean, we want to actually discuss about the Varnasrama mission and global government. We didn't get a chance to do that. But at one point, Prabhupada, as we recall, had blessed sanction that some of his disciples, run for different government positions. The In God We Trust political party in America, which Prabhupada sanctioned at one particular time. But after some time, Prabhupada kind of mentioned that, okay, we're not ready for that. But the fact remains that Srila Prabhupada expected that at some particular point, society has to come to that situation to reestablish a God-conscious, Krishna-conscious society. The leaders of the society will have to be devotees. The Vaishyas will have to be devotees. The Shudras will have to be devotees.
Also, we need to, so far in ISKCON, we've defined temple management systems. Here in Mayapur, for instance, we've grown way beyond the temple. We've become a town. And we have to evolve now into town level of management, in the sense of your infrastructure needs, like a town has a mayor, which makes sure that the city runs, the roads, the traffic, the public services are running, etc., etc. The temple president is beyond the temple president's scope. But of course you need to have a leader, like you said, the temple president you were equating as being the Kshatriya. So we ought to need to have kind of clearly delineated ways in which our village works. So everyone understands, one aspect being the Brahmins being independent, so they can speak out. If the Kshatriya does say something or propose something which is off, the Brahmins, because they're independent, they immediately say, well, this is not according to Shastra. So in that way, you also get that kind of sense of that balance. So that can be achieved. It's just a question of recognizing there's a need for a structural change or a structural put in place, and then following it.
So that means that the Brahmins wouldn't be under the control of the Kshatriyas? Because if they were, a mistake they may, say if they're depending on the Kshatriyas for their maintenance, whatever they be, then they may be influenced by their decision making, as far as what they say. So they need the freedom to speak their mind honestly. So that means they're totally independent from the Kshatriya.
Correct. Yeah, they're independent. at the same time, if they break the rules, you know, everyone's under the rules. So if the Brahmins break the rules, you know, they're the ones that make the rules. So if they break the rules, obviously, then they are, you know, actually the Brahmins can't be chastised. But anyway,
their authority is...
Yeah, their authority is basically gone out the window. So, but as long as they live upstanding lives and they're clearly, you know, Brahmins, then they will get an influence there. You know, people will listen to them. They know this is a good Brahmin. And what he said carries weight. So the Kshatriyas also kind of like, well, you know, Kshatriyas don't quite have that level, the Brahmins have. So there will always be that kind of, they will have that hierarchy, they will have that power over the Brahmins, over the Kshatriyas.
Could we, by your presentation, could we understand two types of application for varnashram? Like there is this progressive way that a person comes and does work as shudra until he qualifies and is given more responsibility, and gradually he gets all the society fixes and dynamically structures. And the other proposal was that everyone has to have a very clear concept of what is duty, and that comes. That you make the point that is very hard, because nowadays is opposite to the common culture. And the line of thinking was that one has to be a very good devotee Shudra, very good devotee Vaishya, very qualified devotee Brahmana, very qualified devotee Kshatriya. So this looks like another type of application that everyone has already been selected and can be put in a very high project of our nation. And otherwise this dynamic construction that maybe a lot of devotees nowadays, as you said, are qualified or very quickly can become qualified to enter this structure. Is this two different types of application?
The example that I gave with a young men becoming a laborer and then a carpenter's helper and so on like that. You might equate that to a young man who's growing up who has the, let's say, the ability of a kshatriya, but that's of course not completely fully manifest when he's just beginning, so he has to learn different stages. A person can only advance to the level of their ability. If he doesn't have the ability, he's not going to get past being a shudra. He doesn't have more abilities, can't get past the innovation. So that's how I meant to use that example. I didn't mean to indicate that we can change our varna. That's another kind of discussion. One problem is that we are already varna shankara. We're mixed varnas. Which means most of us, we have several different tendencies. We have some tendency for being perhaps vicious, and some tendency for being vana, something like that. Who am I? Pick one. In regards to what was the second point you were saying was, say that again.
Is that this perfect varnashram structure can be attained only by a cultural difference and by a very high standard devotees.
Yeah, well, the devotees who can practice at that high standard, they are meant to give an example to others in society. They still follow the rules and regulations of varnashram according to their duty. This duty is prescribed in Manu Samhita. We don't have to guess what is it. We can go directly to the Dharma Shastras, and it's carefully explained there.
How are these two different kinds of two different applications of Karnataka?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I go back and forth on that idea myself. That there should be an ideal community that others can come and observe and see how it functions. And then other times I think, well, no, they should both be working side by side so that they have the example immediately in front of them. I'm not sure. Any comment?
One point of understanding I have is, since nobody is qualified, and Varnashram is very much, very less understood, and lot of knowledge is forgotten, that's why Srila Prabhupada said immediately we need to establish Varnashram colleges, where we need to train them up and get them qualified and then establish Varnashram colleges. So, yeah, that's one way of putting it.
Yeah, that's a very important consideration, because most people, because of the educational system we have now, most people have not been able to realize their potential in their varna. I gave an example earlier of a child is a kshatriya nature and they're in a Western classroom. The teacher demands quiet and order. And if you've got a rowdy kid, it's causing a problem. So you tell him, shut up and sit down! And that kid, he's just a kid. He's got a kshatriya nature, but he's a kid. He gets crushed. Yeah, his spirit gets crushed. That kid needs to be on a horse with a bow and arrow. You know, he needs to have that kind of opportunity to be powerful kshatriya. But the teacher is an adult with power, he crushes. So most of us have had our spirits crushed. Whatever varna we could potentially have been, we've got a varna, but it's crushed. Our spirit is broken. Prabhupada describes in the Bhagavatam how these spirits are there. Four different types of spirit. So for most adults, it will be difficult. Because, you know, as Prabhupada said, you know, we're not quite sure what we can do. We can do so many things, but what's our real... We've been crushed. But in a gurukula system where the children can actually be taught, you know, the teachers are looking, what varna does this child have? And then they encourage them actively and they give them engagement according to that varna. Those children can become much more powerful. They can actually realize. And so they are actually the future hope. That was why Prabhupada introduced gurukulas way back. And farm communities simultaneously, because both are required. Farm communities and gurukulas, the gurukulas grow up, they've got the farm to be able to, you know, reach their full potential according to their varna. So in that sense, then there's no problem. You know, it becomes clarified. There's no mystery in it. We should probably break. We should break now because it gets 5 o'clock and we're going to stop at 6. So we should break, what, 10, 15 minutes? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So if we'll come back here within 15 minutes, that would be really excellent. Thank you.
Well, later I'll speak about my analysis and my process. What's older than what he's from? He's from Canada.
He's an artist, but quite himself. What does he say? How long do you think you want to go there? From 6 o'clock?
No, I don't speak for half an hour. Discussion. Yeah.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. No, I missed part of it again.
It's all there.
Okay.
You have flash drive?
No, I don't.
Well, half your life is...
That's right. That was it. Probably still sitting on my, I thought I swore I packed it.
Do you have a flash drive? Oh, you don't have one with you.
You have a flashlight?
Yeah. Do you have a computer here?
Yeah.
Okay. I need my patch cord.
A what?
I need my mini USB to get it off.
Do you have one?
I got one downstairs. Just come downstairs with me afterward.
I just wanted to mention one thing. I've seen a lot of discussion online on all these different subjects, and some of it
goes on endlessly.
It goes on endlessly, exactly, for years. And some of, more and more, I don't really keep up with it much, but I've seen more, it seems, recently. Devotees talking, that were certain words, I should say, they started talking about Dharma Shastras, and then someone even said, Gandhi, just different things coming in like this. And my opinion is that what Srila Prabhupada said about Varnashram is one thing, and what the Dharma Shastras and other Shastras say. For example, I believe that you can, I don't know how bona fide translations are, but you can pull up some of these things and you can read things like, if you see a sudra, you're supposed to spit on it, or something like that, These things are there.
I think it's there.
No? Not at all.
I never read that one.
So there's never any denigration of the...
Well, I've only read the Manu Samhita, I haven't read the other Dharma Shastras. I haven't read Arkashastra.
Oh, Manu Samhita? Manu Samhita has nothing like that at all.
Derogatory?
Yeah.
Not that I recall.
No, in fact, derogatory reason would be a kind of one of the crimes in that sense.
Right. Do you have a source?
No, I get it from Maharaj.
Which one?
Bhaktivedanta Purnamara. He's got an annotated copy in gold.
Okay.
Right. And he has many lectures.
Manu Samhita. So there's nothing, no denigration.
From what I can see from Manu Samhita, it's one of these things where, there are laws there which you couldn't exercise today because they wouldn't be considered by the modern people. I mean, like the sati, for instance, the whole thing of sati is not understood, or child marriage. The West is completely misunderstood.
Right.
But actually, if you look at it in a sociological point of view, it's actually an excellent institution.
I see this as going on in phases. We have this one phase one, phase two, phase three. We can't immediately come to perfection. So we have to work within the confines of the laws of the dominant culture, because anybody wants to challenge it, they'll just go to the court.
Right, it's finished.
So we need to... This is you're making this point also. You need to create your ideology for your community first, and then people can come, you subscribe to it, or you don't. Don't come here and try to change this. You want something different?
Right.
You go somewhere else.
And if it's legitimate, we'll help you set that up too.
Yeah. Which is why I value very much what you're doing, because it helps everybody. Puts all the cards on the table.
Yeah, right.
So everybody can see what's going on.
It's just like me. In the community I live in, no dogs.
My exact sentiment.
I know. I got God brothers and God sisters in Dallas that have dogs.
If you have dogs like they're here in my place. These dogs are polite and well-mannered.
Oh my! I wrote a letter to the GDC last year. I'm going to write another one this year.
About the dogs here?
Yes.
What are they doing?
Are you kidding? They're copulating on the streets and pooping on
dogs.
The sidewalks and
they could be,
howling in the middle of the night.
There's no one.
Isn't it a gated community? We can't keep them out.
No, this has been discussed.
They weren't here before.
For the last 20, well, since I've been involved in 1990 here in Mayapur, I remember 91, 92 was a big topic of dogs. And many ideas were suggested, like a one way tunnel under Ganga. I've actually seen dogs jump in boats and come across.
Wow.
Because the boats have these platforms, they jump and go under the platform, no one can get them out, they come across and then they get off. And so, it's like, but the problem here is that we've got no solid waste management. You may have seen when you go to the garden sometimes, it's full of dogs, right?
Yes.
So, in that sense, they thrive, you know, because they've got free food everywhere.
Yes.
So, you know, if you have a bit more of a solid waste management system,
that would help.
Then they will, because what happens is every year when there's a flood, there's no dogs.
Right.
Unless they've got aqualungs or something. But the dogs have to go miles and miles away.
Right.
Because there's just water everywhere. Sometimes you've got a dog stranded, you hear them crying for days, and then someone might come rescue or something. The dogs just go up some miles away.
But they never used to be like this.
No, because the fact now is that there's so many more people, there's so much more food available just lying around.
I think that's so the only reason. Just,
yeah, that's what always happens. You know, when you've got a creature
at the market, people feed them.
That's right. If you've got a creature, if you've got some, you know, some creatures and you've got plenty of food, and there's no predators,
right,
then you get a population explosion. Right.
Right? I agree with that, but I don't remember them being in. I mean, isn't everything gated off? Isn't there a gate?
At one point, no, there's no. It's porous. You know, it's completely porous. There's no. You know, there's just fences with. You know,
oh, it's big open.
There's no. It's completely porous. It would cost a fortune to put in a barrier to stop the dog.
Okay.
And at one point, we did actually have a dog catcher.
Yeah.
You know, and he had a rickshaw with a cage in the back, and they'd go around, and you'd hear them, and you'd hear all these dogs crying, and many of the residents freaked out. You know,
really?
How can you do this? These darn bastards, you know. And there are stories of dogs. I mean, I remember the dog on Padiatra used to. He started following us when I was on Padiatra, especially when we started Rajmana Parakum. And after a little while, everyone recognized this dog as the bogey.
Right.
Because he would just walk on, whenever we walked, he would walk, and then he would disappear at night, and then the next morning he'd be there walking with us, and he died actually on Padiatra.
Yes. Shivan and the Saints dog.
We talked about it after that, you know.
Shivan and the Saints dog, right?
Right. So, yeah. You know, in that sense, they've been born in the dharma. So the only thing you can really do is just control them by being a little bit more careful with what you chuck out, etc., etc. Then you'll get a much more manageable, less botheration kind of population of dogs.
He doesn't have that problem in America. He can keep dogs off, no problem. I used to feel that way. Somewhere over there, I'm already out.
Yeah, I am a little.
I had a piece of land in Mauritius, and the government gave us a couple of acres of land to start a project. And, you know, so I was going along, and we cultivated the land, we grew all our vegetables, we planted bananas and stuff, and then monkeys. And, you know, you've got 2 acres of land, not that big, but it's quite big to run across it. You know, and there's a forest all around the edge of it. So, you know, I'm sitting there, you know, looking out my window, and there's to see a monkey. You know, carrots are coming up, and all these things going up, there's a monkey. So these monkeys, you know, they'll just come in, they'll start eating carrots. You run out, right? They'll just go. They know how far you can throw a stone.
Yep.
Even had firecrackers. They will just go just a little bit beyond, and they're sniffing at you. Yeah. And then you get, you know, if you aim, they're not going to move a little bit back. And as you move forward, they'll come forward, you know. There's, you know, so I got a dog, you know, a dog that would run after them. That would be a little bit more of a challenge, you know. So in some cases, a dog can be a good
egg. Did it work?
Well, I never got a dog.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
okay.
We gave up the project for various reasons. Yeah. So, but I think a dog would have been quite good.
Yeah.
So they have their, you know.
Yes, they do.
You
know, they do.
But at the same time, of course, you don't want it lying on your couch, or, you know, what I mean? Like, to another extreme.
I lived in a village in Ukraine last summer, and a lot of people had dogs, and they didn't work. The places where they bark is where people keep them tied up. But when they can roam around...
Well, that's not my experience in Dallas. The stray dogs roam around in packs. And you'll hear them, you know, just yowling and fighting. And,
because of the dominant culture. No, I would watch their culture, you know. It's kind of like here. The dogs have their own culture, right? Mm-hmm. They have their own space. Mm-hmm. And they... You know, you always see the same dog in the same area, more or less. Dogs, they don't do like dogs in America.
Oh, you hear them? They'll fight once in a while. They'll fight once in a while.
Oh, yeah,
when being bathed.
I don't hear them. No, again, they howl. That's all. In Russia or Ukraine, where they keep their dogs outside tied up,
yeah,
all night long, they howl all night.
All through the winter, right? They keep them outside, tied up all through the winter. I know.
And the summer.
Huge amount of suffering.
And the summer. Well, I don't think it's because of suffering. Maybe it is.
It's very cold in the winter for a dog to be outside.
They don't bark in the summer.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not talking about the barking.
They get used to it being cold. All animals. Animals live outside in the winter. That's their habitat.
Yeah, but they don't. They'll find someplace to stay warm.
Well, of course, they'll dig
a hole,
place if they
can
find one.
Exactly.
Because they're not, you know, they're domesticated
animals.
Some of
these people, they just keep them chained up in no house or nothing.
Usually, the dogs in the village, they would, if they could, they would stay with the cows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cows, so warm.
Oh, yeah.
The cats would also go there.
Yeah.
That's where I would take my bath.
Yeah.
Go to the cow barn and take my bath.
Because the whole building is a little warmer?
Well, there's no wind, yeah, and it's about 10 degrees warmer.
Yeah. Yeah.
These in Nepal, they actually have the cows right underneath the house. So the warmth of the cows goes straight up.
Oh, wow. That's smart.
Yeah.
It's up on stilts, huh?
Yeah, well, not stilts exactly, but it's all enclosed because it's very cold winter in the fall.
Okay, but the first floor is the cow's.
The first floor is the cow's shed,
nice.
Right underneath the main living area. So all of that warmth, you know, it can only go into the building.
Oh, wow.
It's good. And they are, they give a lot of heat.
Yeah. Cool. How much do you, if you have a oxen, for example, and you're working him, you have to feed him a lot more grain? Somebody told me that the other day. I'd never thought about it before.
Well, with cows, if one wanted to milk, you give them some grain.
Right, milk, you know. Okay.
So it would make sense to give a working an animal to milk. I'm not specifically sure, but I haven't heard it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, he was actually talking about horses, but he said, which he had experience with.
Right, right.
But he said the same would be true of cows.
Yeah, cows a lot of grain.
Probably.
Just a little.
He's the expert.
No. Oh. You had a video, sent a video on the...
I asked them.
Oh, you did it?
Okay. No, I don't... I'm completely unprepared. I didn't come to present at all, but...
It'd be nice to see that.
Video. The website will be there in about a month.
Modified seeds. You said after 15 minutes, you'd want to come to...
Run out.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. Yeah, I was waiting for the references for that.
Well, I have...
On YouTube?
At home, no. I have a DVR. Digital recorder, and so I have a couple of channels that are documentary channels, and so I record things from there. So I need to download it from there onto the computer.
Can you put it on YouTube?
It would be very long, 2 hours.
Yeah.
But I can do something with it.
Just hanging out with us. Okay.
Yeah, we're just hanging out.
Well,
we are.
It's good for feeding grains.
Yeah.
They were asking if I were
in cold weather, so some of the food they can actually give them energy.
So they're doing more
kind of food or
something like that. They said I can
I'll just give them like a scoop of what, depending how much you got to work in kind
digital
of
recorder
and how big the animal is.
Yeah, I have a website.
Yeah.
A quarter of a bucket.
Yeah, a quarter of a bucket kind of thing. And lots of the size of the animal really depends on what you work in. Because if you give them too much, also they get really, like it's almost like sugar or something.
Right.
Kind of thing, you know. But, yeah.
Can you give me the barley or something?
What you do, basically, you take your situation, you give them a small amount, see how they do, give them a little bit more, see how it works, that kind of thing, you get an idea of understanding how much to give them, according to what you're kind of doing. But if it's hard work, you want to give them more. It makes a difference, because you can see they can work more. You know. But in hotter countries, I don't know how it works, because it's like if you eat hot...
Location
hot food and
so much
hot time of the year.
Yeah,
it just heats up the body.
Yeah.
He was just telling you, answered your question about the oxen and the grains.
Yeah.
But you do.
How much grains?
You can.
It depends on like where you are. It's like if you're in cold weather or hot weather kind of thing, you know. But the idea that the easiest way to do it is you give us a certain amount, like a small amount, to go with it, see how the animal relates to it. And mostly depending on how much work he's doing. So and then you could always give him a little bit more the next day and see if he works better. And then eventually find out the ratio, what to kind of give him kind of thing.
Because you can't just give them as much as you want.
No. I mean, he'll get spoiled. But the thing is, too, is that hot weather may be different. Hot weather, because it heats up the body.
Mm-hmm.